This horse was an animal of the desert. Its distant ancestors had carried kings and Bedouin chieftains over the burning wastes of Arabia. Its bloodlines had been taken north by the Crusaders to the colder climes of Europe, and then hundreds of years later they had been brought out to Africa, again by the colonial expedition of Germany, and landed at the point of Lüderitzbucht with the cavalry squadrons of Bismarck. In Africa, these horses had been crossed and recrossed with the shaggy, hardy mounts of the Boers and the desert-forged animals of the Hottentots, until this animal emerged, a creature well-suited to this rugged environment and to the tasks to which it was committed. It had the wide nostrils and fine head of its Arabian type, broad spatulate hooves to cover the soft desert earth, great lungs in its barrel chest, pale chestnut coloration to repel the worst of the sun's rays, a shaggy coat to insulate it from both the burning noon heat and the crackling cold of the desert nights, and the legs and heart to carry its rider to far, milky horizons and beyond. The man upon his back was also of mixed bloodlines, and, like his mount, a creature of the desert and the boundless land. His mother had come out from Berlin when her father had been appointed second-in-command of the military forces in German West Africa. She had met and, despite her family's opposition, married a young Boer from a family rich only in land and spirit. Lothar was the only child of that union, and at his mother's insistence had been sent back to Germany to complete his schooling. He had proved a good scholar, but the outbreak of the Boer War had interrupted his studies. The first his mother had known of his decision to join the Boer forces was when he arrived back in Windhoek unannounced. Hers was a warrior family, so her pride was fierce when Lothar had ridden away with a Hottentot servant and three spare horses to seek his father, was already in the field against the English. Lothar had found his father at Marchesfontein, with his uncle Koers de la Rey, the legendary Boer commander, and had undergone his initiation to battle 2 days later when the British tried to force the passage to the Marchesfontein hills and relieve the siege of Kimberley. Lothar de la Rey was 5 days past his 14th birthday on the dawn of the battle, and he killed his first Englishman before 6 that morning. It had been a less difficult target than 100 springbok and running kuru had offered him before. Lothar, one of the 500 picked marksmen, had stood to the parapet of the trench that he had helped dig along the foot of the Marchesfontein hills. The idea of digging a trench and using it as cover had at first repelled the Boers, who were essentially horsemen and loved to range fast and wide. Yet General de la Rey had persuaded them to try this new tactic, and the lines of advancing English infantry had walked unsuspectingly onto the trenches in the deceptive early light. Leading the advance towards where Lothar lay was a powerful, thick-set man with flaming red mutton-chop whiskers. He strode a dozen paces ahead of the line, his kilt swinging jauntily, a tropical pith helmet set at a rakish angle over one eye, and a bared sword in his right hand. At that moment, the sun rose over the Marchesfontein hills, and its ripe orange light flooded the open, featureless veldt. It lit the ranks of advancing Boer Highlanders like a stage effect, perfect shooting light, and the Boers had paced out the range in front of their trenches and marked them with cairns of stones. Lothar took his aim on the centre of the Englishman's forehead, but like the men beside him was held by a strange reluctance, for there seemed not much short of murder. Then, almost at its own volition, the Mauser jumped against his shoulder, and the crack of the shot seemed to come from very far away. The British officer's helmet sprang from his head and spun end over end. He was driven back a pace, and his arms flew open. The sound of the bullet striking the man's skull came back to Lothar like a ripe watermelon dropped onto a stone floor. The sword flashed in the sunlight as it fell from the soldier's hand. Then, with a slow, almost elegant pirouette, he sank into the low, coarse scrub. Hundreds of Highlanders had lain pinned in front of the trenches all that day. Not a man of them dared lift his head, for the waiting rifles in the trenches 100 paces from where they lay were wielded by some of the finest marksmen in the world. The African sun burned the backs of their knees below the kilts until they swelled, and the skin burst open like overripe fruit. The wounded Highlanders cried for water, and some of the Boers in the trenches threw their water bottles towards them, but they fell short. Though Lothar had killed 50 men since then, that was the day he would remember all his life. He always marked it as the day he had become a man. Lothar was not among those who had thrown his water bottle. Instead, he had shot dead 2 of the Englishmen as they wriggled forward on their bellies to try and reach the water bottles. His hatred of the English, learned at the knees of both his mother and his father, had truly begun to flower that day, and had come into full fruiting in the years that followed. The English had hunted him and his father like wild animals across the veldt. His beloved aunt and 3 female cousins had died of diphtheria, the white sore throat, in the English concentration camps, but Lothar had made himself believe the story that the English had put fishhooks in the bread that they fed the Boer women to rip out their throats. It was an English thing, this war on the women and the young girls and the children. He and his father and his uncles had fought on long after all hope of victory was gone. The Bitter Enders, they called themselves with pride. When the others, starved to walking skeletons, sick with dysentery and covered with the running ulcerations which they called felt sores, caused by exposure and malnutrition, dressed in their rags and sacking, with only 3 rounds apiece remaining in their bandoliers, had gone in to surrender to the English at Vereeniging, Pietrus de la Rey and his son Lothar had not gone in with them. "Witness my oath, O Lord of my people," Pietrus had stood bareheaded in the veldt with his 17-year-old son Lothar beside him. "The war against the English will never end. This I swear in your sight, O Lord God of Israel." Then he had placed the black leather-covered Bible in Lothar's hands and made him swear the same oath. "The war against the English will never end." Lothar had stood beside his father as he cursed the traitors, the cowards who would no longer fight on. Louis Buerta and Janni Smuts, even his own brother Koos de la Rey, "You would sell your people to the Philistine. May you live all your lives under the English yoke and all burn in hell for 10,000 years. Then the father and the boy had turned their backs and ridden away towards the vast arid land that was the domain of Imperial Germany and left the others to make peace with England. Because both father and son were strong, hard workers, both of them endowed with natural shrewdness and courage, because Lothar's mother was a German of good family with excellent connections and some wealth, they had prospered in German Southwest Africa. Pietrus de la Rey, Lothar's father, was a self-taught engineer of considerable skill and ingenuity. What he did not know, he could improvise. The saying was, "Een boer maakt altijd een plan." A boer will always make a plan. Through his wife's connections, he obtained the contract to reconstruct the breakwater of Lüderitzbucht harbour, and when that was successfully completed, the contract to build the railway line northwards from the Orange River to Windhoek, the capital of German Southwest. He taught Lothar his engineering skills. The boy learned swiftly, and by the age of 21 was a full partner in the construction and road-building company of de la Rey and son. His mother, Christina de la Rey, selected a pretty blonde German girl of good family and moved her diplomatically into her son's orbit, and they were married before Lothar's 23rd birthday. She bore Lothar a beautiful blonde son, on whom he doted. Then the English intruded upon their lives once more, threatening to plunge the entire world into war by opposing the legitimate ambitions of the German Empire. Lothar and his father had gone to Governor Zeitz with an offer to build up, at their own expense, supply dumps in the remote areas of the territory to be used by the German forces to resist the English invasion, which would surely come from the Union of South Africa, now governed by those traitors and turncoats Smuts and Louis Botha. There had been a German naval captain in Windhoek at the time. He had quickly recognised the value of the Delarey offer and prevailed on the governor to accept it. He had sailed with the father and son along that dreadful littoral that so well deserved the name Skeleton Coast, to select a site for a base from which German naval vessels could refuel and revictual even after the ports of Luritzbucht and Walvis Bay were captured by the Union forces. They discovered a remote and protected bay 300 miles north of the tenuous settlements at Walvis Bay and Swakopmund, a site almost impossible to reach overland, for it was guarded by the fiery deserts. They loaded a small coastal steamer with the naval stores sent out to them secretly from Bremerhaven in a German cruise ship. There were 500 tons of fuel oil in 44-gallon drums, engine spares and canned foods, small arms and ammunition, 9-inch naval shells, and 14 of the long Mark 7 acoustic torpedoes to rearm the German U-boats if they should ever operate in these southern oceans. These supplies were ferried ashore and buried amongst the towering dunes. The lighters were painted with protective tar and buried with the stores. This secret supply base was finally established only weeks before the Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated at Sarajevo and the Kaiser was forced to move against the Serbian revolutionaries to protect the interests of the German Empire. Immediately, France and Britain had seized upon this as a pretext for precipitating the war after which they had been lusting. Lothar and his father saddled their horses and called out their Hottentot servants, kissed their women and Lothar's son farewell, and rode out on commando against the English and their Unionist minions once again. They were 600 strong, riding under the Boer General Maritz, when they reached the Orange River and built their lager and waited for the moment to strike. Each day, armed men rode in to join them. Tough, bearded men, proud, hard fighters with the Mausers slung on their shoulders and the bandoliers of ammunition criss-crossing their wide chests. After each joyous greeting, they gave their news, and it was all good. The old comrades were flocking to the cry of "Commando!" Everywhere Boers were repudiating the treacherous peace which Smuts and Botha had negotiated with the English. All the old Boer generals were taking to the field. De Wet was camped at Mushroom Valley. Kemp was at Trierfontein with 800. Beyers and Fourie were all out and had declared for Germany against England. Smuts and Botha seemed reluctant to precipitate a conflict between Boer and Boer, for the Union forces consisted of 70% Dutch-born soldiers. They were begging, wheedling and pleading with the rebels, sending envoys to their camps, prostrating themselves in the attempt to avoid bloodshed. But each day the rebel forces grew stronger and more confident. Then a message reached them, carried by a horseman riding in great haste across the desert from Windhoek. It was a message from the Kaiser himself, relayed to them by Governor Zeitz. Admiral Graf von Spee, with his squadron of battle cruisers, had won a devastating naval battle at Coronel on the Chilean coast. The Kaiser had ordered von Spee to round the Horn and cross the southern Atlantic to blockade and bombard the South African ports in support of their rebellion against the English and the Unionists. They stood under the fierce desert sun and cheered and sang, united and sure of their cause and certain of their victory. They were waiting only for the last of the Boer generals to come in to join them before they marched on Pretoria. Koos de la Rey, Lothar's uncle, grown old and feeble and indecisive, had still not come in. Lothar's father sent messages to him, urging him to do his duty, but he vacillated, swayed by the treacherous oratory of Janni Smuts and his misguided love and loyalty for Louis Botha. Koen Brits was the other Boer leader they were waiting for. that giant of granite, standing 6 foot 6 inches tall, who could drink a bottle of fiery Cape smoke the way a lesser man might quaff a mug of ginger beer, who could lift a track ox off its feet, spit a stream of tobacco juice a measured 20 paces, and with his Mauser hit a running springbok at 200 paces. They needed him, for 1,000 fighting men would follow him when he decided which way to ride. However, Yanni Smuts sent this remarkable man a message. "Call out your commando, Oom Koen, and ride with me." The reply was immediate. "Ja, my old friend, we are mounted and ready to ride. But who do we fight? Germany or England?" So they lost Brits to the Unionists. Then Koos de la Rey, travelling to a final meeting with Yanni Smuts at which he would make his decision, ran into a police roadblock outside Pretoria and instructed his chauffeur to drive through it. The police marksman shot him in the head, so they lost de la Rey. Of course, Yanni Smuts, that cold, crafty devil, had an excuse. He said that the roadblock had been ordered to prevent the escape of the notorious band of bank robbers, the Foster Gang, from the area, and that the police had opened fire on a mistaken identity. However, the rebels knew better. Lothar's father had wept openly when they received the news of his brother's murder, and they had known that there was no turning back, no further chance for parley. They would have to carry the land at rifle point. The plan was for all the rebel commandos to join up with Maritz on the Orange River, but they had underestimated the new mobility of the forces against them, afforded by the petrol-driven motor car. They had forgotten also that Botha and Smuts had long ago proved themselves the most able of all the Boer generals. When at last they moved, these two moved with the deadly speed of angry mambas. They caught De Wet at Mushroom Valley and smashed his commando with artillery and machine guns. They were terrible casualties, and De Wet fled into the Kalahari, pursued by Koen Brits and a motorized column that captured him at Waterberg in the desert. Then the Unionists swung back and engaged Beyers and his commando near Rustenburg. Once the battle was lost, Beyers tried to escape by swimming the flooded Vaal River. His bootlaces became entangled, and they found his body 3 days later on the bank downstream. On the Orange River, Lothar and his father waited for the inevitable onslaught, but bad news reached them before the Unionists did. The English admiral, Sir Doveton Sturdy, had intercepted von Spee at the Falkland Islands and sunk his great cruisers Scharnhorst and Gneisenau, and the rest of his squadron, with only 10 British seamen, killed. The rebels' hope of succour had gone down with the German fleet. Still, they fought doggedly when the Unionists came, but it was in vain. Lothar's father took a bullet through the gut, and Lothar carried him off the field, and tried to get him back across the desert to Windhoek, where Christina could nurse him. It was 500 miles of terrible going through the waterless wastes. The old man's pain was so fierce that Lothar wept for him, and the wound was contaminated by the contents of his perforated intestines and mortified so that the stench brought the hyenas howling around the camp at night. But he was a tough old man, and it took him many days to die. "Promise me, my son," he demanded with his last breath that stank of death. "Promise me that the war with the English will never end." "I promise you, father." Lothar leaned over him to kiss his cheek, and the old man smiled and closed his eyes. Lothar buried him under a camel-thorn tree in the wilderness. He buried him deeply so that the hyena would not smell him and dig him up. Then he rode on home, to Windhoek. Colonel Frank, the German commander, recognized Lothar's value and asked him to raise a levy of scouts. Lothar assembled a small band of hardy Boers, German settlers, Bonelswart Hottentots, and black tribesmen, and took them out into the desert to await the invasion of Unionist troops. Smuts and Botha came with 45,000 men and landed at Swakopmund and Luritzbucht. From there they drove into the interior, employing their usual tactics, lightning-forced marches, often without water for great distances, double-pronged attacks and encircling movements, using the new-fangled petrol-driven motor cars, the same way they had used horses during the Boer War. Against this multitude, Frank had 8,000 German troops to defend a territory of over 300,000 square miles, with a 1,000-mile coastline. Lothar and his scouts fought the Unionists with their own tactics, poisoning the waterholes ahead of the Union troops, dynamiting the railway lines, hooking around them to attack their supply lines, setting ambushes and landmines, raiding at night and at dawn, driving off the horses, pushing his scouts to even their far borders of endurance. It was all unavailing. Botha and Smuts caught the tiny German army between them, and with the casualty list of only 530 dead and wounded, exacted an unconditional surrender from Colonel Frank, but not from Lothar de la Rey. To honour the promise he had made to his father, he took what remained of his band of scouts northwards into the dreaded Cacao Felt to continue the struggle. Lothar's mother Christina and his wife and child went into the internment camp for German nationals that was set up by the Unionists at Windhoek, and there all three of them died. They died in a typhoid epidemic, but Lothar de la Rey knew who was ultimately to blame for their deaths, and in the desert he cherished and nourished his hatred, for it was all that he had left. His family was slain by the English, and his estate seized and confiscated. Hatred was the fuel that drove him forward. He was thinking of his murdered family now, as he stood at his horse's head on the crest of one of the high dunes that overlooked the green Atlantic Ocean, where the Benguela current steamed in the early sunlight. His mother's face seemed to rise out of the twisting fog banks before him. She had been a beautiful woman, tall and statuesque, with thick blonde hair that hung to her knees when she brushed it out, but which she wore twisted into thick, plaited golden ropes on top of her head to enhance her height. Her eyes had been golden also, with a direct, cold gaze of a leopardess. She could sing like one of the Valkyries from Wagner, and she had passed on to Lothar her love of music and learning and art. She had passed on to him also her fine looks, classical, Teutonic features, and the dense curls that now hung to his shoulders from under the wide Terai hat with the waving bunch of ostrich feathers stuck jauntily in the puggaree. Like Christina's, his hair was the colour of newly minted bronze, but his eyebrows were thick and dark over the golden leopard eyes that were now probing the silver mists of the Benguela. The beauty of the scene moved Lothar, the way that music could, like the violins playing Mozart. It induced in him the same feeling of mystic melancholy at the centre of his soul. The sea was green and still, not a ripple spoiled in its velvety sheen. The low and gentle sound of the ocean swelled and subsided like the breathing of all creation. Yet, along the shoreline, the dense growth of dark sea kelp absorbed the sea's motion, and there was no break of white water. The kelp beds danced a slow, graceful minuet, bowing and undulating to the rhythm of the ocean. The horns of the bay were armed with rock, split into geometric shapes and streaked white with the droppings of the seabirds and seals that basked upon them. The coats of the seal glowed in the mist-filtered sunlight, and their weird honking cries carried on the windless air to where Lothar stood on the crest of the dune high above them. In the throat of the bay, the rock gave way to tawny, lion-coloured beach, and behind the first dune was trapped a wide lagoon, hemmed in by nodding reed beds, the only green in this landscape. In its shallow waters, there waded troops of long-legged flamingo. The marvellous pink of their massed formations burned like unearthly fire, drawing Lothar's gaze away from his search of the sea. The flamingo were not the only birds upon the lagoon. There were troops of pelican and white egrets, solitary blue herons, and a legion of smaller long-legged waders foraging the food-rich waters. The dunes upon which Lothar waited rose like the crested back of a monstrous serpent, writhing and twisting along the shoreline, rising 500 feet and more against the misty sky, their restless, ever-changing bulk sculptured by the sea wind into soft plastic coils and knife-sharp peaks. Suddenly, far out on the sea, there was a dark boil of movement, and the silky green surface changed to the colour of gunmetal. Lothar felt the jump of his nerves and the race of anticipation through his veins as his gaze darted to it. Was this what he had waited and kept vigil for all these weary weeks? He lifted the binoculars that hung upon his chest and felt a slide of disappointment. What he had seen was merely a shoal of fish, but what a shoal! The tip-top of the living mass dimpled the surface, but, as he watched, the rest of the vast shoal rose to feed on the rich green plankton, and the commotion spread out until as far as he could see, to the edge of the fog banks 3 miles out. The ocean seethed and boiled with life. It was a shoal of pilchards 5 miles across, each individual only as long as a man's open hand, but in their countless millions generating the power to move the ocean. Over this mighty multitude, the yellow-headed gannets and hysterical gulls shrieked and wheeled and plunged, their bodies kicking up white puffs of spray as they hit the water. Squadrons of seals charged back and forth like the cavalry of the sea, breaking the water white as they gorged on the silver masses, and through this gluttonous chaos the triangular fins of the great sharks passed with the stately motion of tall sailing ships. For an hour, Lothar watched in wonder, and then abruptly, as though at a signal, the entire living mass sounded, and within minutes the stillness descended over the ocean again. The only movement was the gentle swell of waters and the soft advance and retreat of the silver fog banks under the watery sun. Lothar hobbled his horse, took a book from his saddlebag, and settled on the warm sand. Every few minutes he raised his eyes from the page. But the hours wore away, and at last he stood and stretched and went to his horse. His fruitless vigil ended for another day. With one foot in the stirrup, he paused and made a last careful survey of a seascape smudged to bloody carnelian and dull brass by the sunset. Then, even as he watched, the sea opened before his eyes, and out of it rose an enormous dark shape, in the image of Leviathan, but greater than any living denizen of the oceans. Shining with wetness, gleaming water streaming from its decks and steel sides, it wallowed upon the surface. "At last!" Lothar shouted with excitement and relief. "I thought they would never come." He stared avidly through his monoculars at the long, sinister black vessel. He saw the encrustations of barnacle and weed that fouled the hull. She had been long at sea and battered by the elements. On the tall conning tower, her registration numerals were almost obliterated. U-32. Lothar read them with difficulty, and then his attention was diverted by activity on the submarine's foredeck. From one of the hatches, a gun team swarmed out and ran forward to man the quick-firing cannon near the bows. They were taking no chances. Lothar saw the weapons traverse towards him, ready to reply to any hostile gesture from the shore. On the conning tower, human heads appeared, and he saw binoculars trained towards him. Hastily, Lothar found the signal rocket in his saddlebag. Its glowing red fireball arced out over the sea and was answered immediately by a rocket from the submarine, hurling skywards on a tail of smoke. Lothar flung himself onto the back of his mount and pushed him over the edge of the dune. They went sliding down, the horse squatting on its haunches and bringing down a slipping, hissing cascade of sand around them. At the bottom of the dune, Lothar gathered his mount, and they went flying across the hard, damp beach, with Lothar waving his hat, standing in the stirrups and shouting with laughter. He rode into the camp at the edge of the lagoon and sprang from the saddle. He ran from one of the crude shelters of driftwood and canvas to the next, dragging out his men and kicking them from their blankets. "They have come, you sleeping lizards! They have come, you pups of desert jackals! Come on, get off your buttocks before they rot!" They were an unlikely gang of cutthroats that Lothar had assembled. Tall, muscled hereros, yellow Mongol-faced Hottentots with slanted eyes, fierce Koranas and sly, handsome Avambos, dressed in tribal finery and the lootings of the battlefields, in cloaks of softly tanned hide of kudu and zebra, in the feathers of ostrich and the tattered tunics and helmets of the Union soldiers they had killed. Armed with Mannlicher and Mauser and Martini Henry and Lee Enfield 303s, with knife and spear, they were as bloodthirsty as hunting dogs, as wild and savage and unpredictable as the desert that had spawned them. They called only one man their master. If any other had lifted a hand to them, or spurned them with his foot, they would have slit his throat or put a ball through the back of his skull. But Lothar de la Rey kicked them to their feet and drove the laggards before him with his fists. "Move, you devourers of hyena dung! The English will be upon you before you have finished scratching your lice." The two lighters were hidden in the reeds. They had come up on the transport with the rest of the stores in those heady days just before the outbreak of war, in the weeks that they had waited for the U-boat. His men had re-corked the seams with oakum and tar and fashioned rollers from the driftwood that littered the beaches. Now, at Lothar's urging, they dragged the sturdy wooden boats from the reeds, 20 men straining at each side, for the boats were heavy. They had been built to carry 40 tons of guano each, and still stank of seabird droppings. They had wide beam and deep draught, and the wooden rollers laid across the beach sank into the tawny sand as the weight of the hulls passed over them. They left the two boats at the edge of the water and then hurried back to where the drums of fuel oil were buried at the foot of the dune. They heaved them from the damp sand and rolled them down the beach. Already Lothar had rigged a tripod and tackle, and the 44-gallon drums were hoisted and lowered into the lighters. As they worked, the light faded away into the desert night, and the submarine merged with the darkness of the ocean.
"Everybody to help launch!"
Lothar bellowed, and his men swarmed out of the darkness and began the rhythmic work chant, each concerted heave moving the heavily laden lighter a few inches forward, until the water lifted her and she'd slid forward and floated free. Lothar stood in the bows with a storm lantern held high, and his oarsmen drove the lighter, almost gunwale deep, through the cold black waters. In the blackness ahead, a signal lamp flashed to guide them, and then abruptly the high dark bulk of the U-boat loomed out of the night, and the lighter bumped against its side. German seamen were ready with mooring lines, and one of them gave Lothar an arm as he leaped the gap and scrambled up the steep steel side. The U-boat captain was waiting for him on the bridge.
"Unterseeboot Kapitän Kurt Kohler."
He clicked his heels and saluted, then stepped forward to shake Lothar's hand.
"I am very happy to see you, Herr de la Rey. We have only enough fuel oil left for 2 days steaming."
In the glow of the bridge light, the submariner was gaunt-faced. His skin had the waxy pallor of a creature that had lived away from the light for a long time. His eyes had sunk into dark cavities, and his mouth was like the scar from a saber cut. Lothar could recognize that here was a man who had come intimately to understand death and fear there in the dark and secret depths.
"You have had a successful cruise, Captain?"
126 days at sea and 26,000 tons of enemy shipping," the submariner nodded.
"With God's help, another 26,000 tons," Lothar suggested.
"With God's help and your fuel oil," the captain agreed, and glanced down at the deck where the first drums were being swayed aboard. Then he looked back at Lothar. "You have torpedoes?" he asked anxiously.
"Content yourself," Lothar reassured him. "The torpedoes are ready, but I thought it prudent to refuel before rearming."
"Of course." Neither of them had to mention the consequence of the U-boat, with her tanks empty, being caught against a hostile shore by an English warship.
"I still have a little schnapps," the captain changed the subject. "My officers and I would be honored."
As Lothar descended the steel ladder into the submarine's interior, he felt his gorge rise. The stench was a solid thing, so that he wondered that any man could endure it more than a few minutes. It was the smell of 60 men living in a confined space for months on end, living without sunlight or fresh air, without the means of washing their bodies or their clothing. It was the smell of pervading damp and of the fungus that turned the uniforms green and rotted the cloth of their bodies, the stench of hot fuel oil and bilges, of greasy food and the sickly sweet of fear, the clinging odour of bedding that had been slept in for 126 days and nights, of socks and boots that were never changed, and the reek of sewage buckets which could only be emptied once every 24 hours. Lothar hid his revulsion and clicked his heels and bowed when the captain introduced his junior officers. The overhead deck was so low that Lothar had to hunch his head down on his shoulders, and the space between the bulkheads was so narrow that the two men were forced to turn sideways to pass each other. He tried to imagine living in these conditions and found his face beading with cold sweat.
"Do you have any intelligence of enemy shipping, Herr Delarey?"
The captain poured a tiny measure of schnapps into each of the crystal glasses and sighed when the last drop fell from the bottle.
"I regret that my intelligence is 7 days old." Lothar saluted the naval officers with a raised glass,
and when they had all drunk, went on, "The troopship Auckland docked at Durban 8 days ago for bunkers. She is carrying 2,000 New Zealand infantry and was expected to sail again on the 15th. There were many sympathisers in the civil service of the Union of South Africa, men and women whose fathers and family had fought in the Boer War and had ridden with Maritz and De Wet against the Union troops. Some of them had relatives who had been imprisoned and even executed for treason once Smuts and Botha had crushed the rebellion. Many of these were employed by the South African Railway and Harbours Authority. Others had key positions in the Department of Post and Telegraphs. Thus, vital information was gathered and swiftly encoded and disseminated to German agents and rebel activists over the Union government's own communication network. Lothar reeled off the list of arrivals and sailings from South African ports and again apologised. "My information is received at the telegraph station at Okahanya, but it takes 5 to 7 days for it to be carried across the desert by one of my men."
"I understand," the German captain nodded. "Nevertheless, the information you have given me will be invaluable in helping me plan the next stage of my operations."
He looked up from the chart on which he had been marking the enemy dispositions, which Lothar had given him, and for the first time noticed his guest's discomfort. He kept his expression attentive and courteous, but inwardly he gloated.
"You great hero! Handsome as an opera star, so brave out there with the wind in your face and the sun shining over your head, I wish I could take you with me and teach you the true meaning of courage and sacrifice. How would you like to hear the English destroyers go drumming overhead as they hunt you? How would you like to hear the click of the primer as the death charge sinks down towards you? Oh, I would enjoy watching your face when the blast beats against the pressure hull and water squirts in through the cracks and the lights go out. How would you like to smell yourself shit with fear in the dark and feel it running hot and liquid down your legs?"
Instead, he smiled and murmured, "I wish I was able to offer you a little more schnapps."
"No, no." Lothar waved the offer aside. This corpse-faced creature and his stinking vessel disgusted and sickened him. "You have been most gracious. I must go ashore and supervise the loading. These Schwarzers, you cannot trust them. Lazy dogs and born thieves, all of them. They understand only the whip and the goad."
Lothar escaped thankfully up the ladder, and in the conning tower sucked the sweet cool night air greedily into his lungs. The submarine captain followed him up.
Herr Delarey, it is essential that we complete the bunkering and stores before dawn. You realize how vulnerable we are here, how helpless we would be, trapped against the shore with our hatches open and our tanks empty? If you could send some of your seamen ashore to assist with the loading. The captain hesitated. Placing his valuable crew on land would make him more vulnerable still. He weighed the odds swiftly. War was all a gambler's throw, risk against reward, for the stakes of death and glory. I will send 20 men to the beach with you. He made the decision in seconds, and Lothar, who had understood his quandary, nodded with reluctant admiration. They had to have light. Lothar built a bonfire of driftwood on the beach, but built a screen between it and the sea, trusting on this and the hovering fog banks to shield them from any searching English warships. By the diffused glow they loaded and reloaded the lighters and rowed them out to the submarine. As each drum of fuel oil was funneled into the vessel's tanks, the empty canister was hurled and thrown overboard to sink into the kelp beds, and gradually the long, slim vessel sank lower in the water. It was 4 in the morning before the fuel tanks were brimming, and the U-boat captain fretted and fumed on his bridge, glancing every few seconds towards the land, where the false dawn was giving a hard knife edge to the dark crests of the dunes, and then down again to the approaching lighter with the long, glistening shape of a torpedo balanced delicately across the thwarts. "Hurry!" He leaned over the gunwale of the conning tower to urge on his men, as they fitted the slings around the monstrous weapon, gingerly took the weight on the straining tackle and swung it on board. The second lighter was already alongside with its murderous burden, and the first lighter was thrashing back towards the beach as the torpedo was eased, gently, into the forward hatch and slid into the empty tube below deck. Swiftly, the light strengthened, and the efforts of the crew and the black guerrillas became frantic as they fought off their fatigue and struggled to complete the loading before full daylight exposed them to their enemies. Lothar rowed out with the last torpedo, sitting casually astride, its shining back as though upon his Arab, and the captain, watching him in the dawn, found himself resenting him more fiercely, hating him for being tall and sun-gilded and handsome, hating him for his casual arrogance and for the ostrich feathers in his hat and the golden curls that hung to his shoulders, but hating him most of all because he would ride away into the desert and leave the U-boat commander to go down again into the cold and deadly waters. "Captain!" Lothar scrambled out of the lighter and climbed the ladder to the bridge of the conning tower. The captain realized that his handsome face was glowing with excitement. "Captain, one of my men has just ridden into camp. He has been 5 days reaching me from Okaanya, and he has news. Splendid news." The captain tried not to let the excitement infect him, but his hands began to tremble as Lothar went on. "The assistant harbour master at Cape Town is one of our men. They are expecting the English heavy battle cruiser, Inflexible, to reach Cape Town within 8 days. She left Gibraltar on the 5th and is sailing direct." The captain dived back into the hatch, and Lothar suppressed his repugnance and followed him down the steel ladder. The captain was already bending eagerly over the chart table with the dividers in his hands, firing questions at his navigating officer. "Give me the cruising speed of the enemy." "Aye, class, battlecruisers." The navigator thumbed swiftly through intelligence files. "Estimated 22 knots or 260 revolutions, captain." "Ha!" The captain was chalking in the approximate course from Gibraltar down the western coastline of the African continent, around the Great Bulge, and then on to the Cape of Good Hope. "Ha!" Again, this time with delight and anticipation. "We can be in patrol position by 1800 hours today if we sail within the hour, and she cannot possibly have passed by then." He raised his head from the chart and looked at his officers, crowded around him. "An English battlecruiser, gentlemen, but not an ordinary one. The Inflexible, the same ship that sank the Scharnhorst at the Falkland Islands. A prize! What a price for us to take to the Kaiser,
and das Vaterland.